Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a PhD holding historian, a professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that makes legit, seriously researched American history come to life through entertaining stories. Join me for a chronological telling of the United States story, from the Revolution to fractious Civil War, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way from 1776 to the early 20th century. Listen to History That Doesn't Suck on Spotify.
Welcome to the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. I'm very glad to have as my guest today G.S. Johnston. He is the author of three historical novels, Consumption, The Skin of Water, and The Cast of the Hand. And it's the history that he researched for The Cast of the Hand that we'll be talking about today. Great book, by the way, and he's joining us from Sydney, Australia. Thank you for your time.
Oh, that's a pleasure to speak to you. I hope my accent is understandable.
Yes, of course. No problem there. So I've written my own series of novels based on true life historical crime events, and I have my own personal reasons for doing so. But a lot of listeners expect a history book to be in a nonfiction format. So I always ask fiction authors who come onto my show why they chose to write history in a fictionalized form.
I enjoy the kind of structure that history gives me as a novelist, because writing a novel is almost about turning things off. When you start researching something, there's so many possibilities you can go in so many directions that you have to actually start making a decision, a first decision, you know, for example, what's the point of view you're going to tell the story from, which then precludes other things kind of happening within the novel. So what I enjoy about writing historical fiction is that it gives me almost a ladder of historical events which I can then weave in and out of. So I find that really easy to work with, I guess.
Where did you first come across the story of the King family murder case?
Initially, I was researching another novel which was partially set in France, and I needed some information about the new building that had been built, courts that had been built in Paris. And I found a book that was centered on the Trotman Kink case, because it was one of the first cases to be trialed within the new building. And gave quite a lot of detail about the case, so I kind of had it on my radar. I was fortunate enough to go to Paris it was 2001, and went to an exhibition of death masks at the Musée d'Orsay, which I think Trotman's hand, the cast of his hand, may have been there. And it just started me thinking about these kind of aspects of the story. So once I'd finished the other novel that I was working on, I started doing some more research into this, and then just kind of became intrigued with it. it did take me a long while to write. It did take over 10 years to finish it, but I wasn't working the whole time on it. There was a long period where I didn't do anything.
So let's get into the history itself. Can you give us some background information on the King family? Who were they, and what kind of business was the father in?
Sure. I think probably it might be a bit more interesting or a bit more helpful to start with where France was at the time, because the case is actually so linked to the political aspects that were going on in at that period. From the period of about 1852 to 1870, France had fairly great economic prosperity. Napoleon III had come to power as emperor and had established what was called the Second Empire. So he had completely refurbished Paris during this period. What we think of as modern Paris was created in that period through Baron Haussmann's establishment of the boulevards. They demolished a lot of the really old areas of Paris. They built the sewer system. They eliminated all the small streets, which there's talk that Napoleon III had wanted this done because the smaller streets had to help the revolutionaries in times like described in Les Misérables. So a lot of this had been achieved with imported credit. He had reformed the banking system. He was a dictator, but I think you would say he was a fairly benevolent dictator. He'd reformed the banking system. He'd done a lot that had really brought a lot of wealth and prosperity to a lot of people across France. But by the beginning of the 1860s, moving into the middle of the 1860s, things had started to unravel a little bit. People were wanting more freedom, a greater democracy. Napoleon III had started to work on this, but it was kind of fairly slow, and a lot of negative forces were gathering around him. His age, his health was beginning to fail, his popularity was declining, the credit that he'd used to do all of these public works was starting to dry up. He'd been involved in a few war skirmishes on the borders, particularly with Prussia. And Bismarck really was lurking on the sidelines, getting towards the mid-1860s. Yeah, so it was a time of great material gains. People had fairly privileged lives, but by the mid to late 60s, it was starting to kind of fall apart. So the background to the major characters of the story, we'd have to first cross over to the eastern side of France to a very small strip of land within Alsace, which was on the border pretty much with Prussia at that time. The borders had kind of changed a few times, so a lot of the cities in the area, for example, had German-sounding names like Mulhouse, and even Jean Kink. His surname, Kink, is, you know, more German than French. So Jean was born in 1826 in Alsace. As he kind of got older, both his parents had died while he was quite young. So the area was fairly economically depressed. And by the time he was about 16 or 17, he moved to the other side of France, up in the north, in an area called the Nord-Pas-de-Calais, near the Belgian border. He was quite young when he went there, but over the next few years, and particularly with the prosperity that the Second Empire brought in, he established a small manufacturing business. The main business of that area was the production of fabric, but he chose to establish a kind of secondary business where he manufactured replacement parts for the machines, for the mills that made the fabric. It's interesting to note that by the mid-1860s, the area did have a bit of an economic stress because the American Civil War had caused the supply of cotton to dry up. But he did survive this. He was quite a shrewd operator. So he had, by the late 1860s, he'd established a fairly good fortune, really. In 1852, just going back a bit, he married a woman from the area, Hortense Roussel. The marriage pretty much lasted the length of the Second Empire. She was an uneducated woman. She was illiterate, which has great bearance on what happened. But she made Jean swear that they would never leave the area. She was quite a provincial woman. She didn't want to leave her parents or her family. So they quickly had a first son, Gustave. Then there was a bit of a hiatus. But then in fairly rapid succession, they had six more children between 1856 and 1867. So going down in order, there was Emile, Henri, Achille, Alfred, Hector, and then finally a girl, Marie. The boy Hector had died when he was quite young. He was the only one of the children who died in infancy. So for the first decade or more of their marriage, they were the very model of a modern French Second Empire family. They were fertile, productive, obedient, and a financial success. Jean had amassed property and business, quite a sizable amount, so it kind of propelled them into the upper middle of middle class, really, and he was continuing to expand. Now we need to kind of just go back over to Alsace, and Jean-Baptiste Tropman was born there in 1848, not very far, actually, from where King's parents had been situated. Trotman's parents were also involved in manufacturing, so even from the beginning, the links to the Kinks started to emerge. His father was an inventor, but he'd been ripped off by a business partner quite early in Jean-Baptiste's life, and he took this person to court and fought them quite hard and was burnt up a lot of money and in the end had to declare himself bankrupt. So this incident bred a certain kind of resentment within the family. Trotman, the boy, Jean-Baptiste, was bright, but he was uneducated, and I think this was blighted by his father's lack of money, his education. His father's financial position recovered somewhat, and he invented a funnel made of papier-mâché that was used in the machines to dye fabric, so it was a disposable kind of object. Trotman and was the youngest and favourite of his mother. He wasn't able to establish how many siblings he had, but he definitely had an older brother and an older sister. He'd been bullied at school. He was incredibly small, but kind of almost a runt, but he had great strength. He had incredibly large hands. Which you need to just remember that fact because it recurs later in the story. He also had a bit of a quick temper. At about 15, he went to work in his father's factory and was kind of an outcast from the other workers. He was the boss's son, although his elder brother worked there and had been accepted. There was a story I found that in an argument with his brother, he smashed his brother with a hammer in the head. But he also showed great strength and agility by pulling a colleague's arm from a machine and saving his arm, even though in doing this he burnt his own hands. But he was in many ways the product of the Second Empire as well. He believed that he could have everything, the material plenty that the empire was offering. But with the overlay that his father had already lost everything, there was a strong sense of entitlement and resentment in him.
Trotman is certainly an incredibly interesting character. How did his relationship develop with Jean Kink?
His father had invented this funnel, like it was a disposable funnel. So Trotman was, his father sent him to Paris, firstly, to install the funnel in some machines there. So he spent quite a bit of time in Paris, in the area around Saint-Denis, which is out near an area that's kind of semi, at that stage, was semi-rural, kind of industrial, newly industrialized area called Patton. And while he was there, he would have met a lot of other Alsatian and Prussian workers who'd been brought into the area or were living in that area and were employed in the redevelopment of Paris, so the building of the boulevards and the sewage system and all the other things that public works at Napoleon III had started at that time. So once this job was finished, initially he was meant to return to Alsace, but then his father sent him to the area around Roubaix, which is where Kink's business was. So at this time, Kink had become to be unsettled. He had started to feel that he was a bit of a foreigner in this area. And I think this probably wasn't unfounded. You know, he would have had quite a strong German accent that would have marked him as not being from this area. And Prussia was making fairly bold murmurings about war at this time, and he was definitely identified with this area. But moreover, he really was a success, and this had probably fostered some ill feeling in the locals. He was also now middle-aged, so I guess, he was probably experiencing some kind of nostalgia and some kind of middle-age crisis. So he did want to return to Alsace, which I think horrified his wife, because this had been a condition when they got married that they would never leave the area. But soon after Jean had started making these announcements, Hortense became pregnant again, which did seem to change Jean's focus, and life settled down. But then he met Trotman, who'd come to the area to work for another factory. It wasn't a large area, it wasn't a large city. So they had met up. Despite the fact that Trotman was, you know, pretty much half Kink's age, to a degree, Trotman was, I think Kink saw Trotman as his younger self. They were both from Alsace. They both moved to the area at about the same time of life. They were involved in similar industries. So despite the fact that his eldest son, Gustav, was now 16, he kind of took Trotman, who was 19 at this time, under his wing. He introduced him to the family and showed him, you know, all the trappings, all the material trappings of his success, really.
Talk about their trip to Herrenfluch together. They start to devise a plan to perhaps make some money together. Is that correct?
You see, this is where it gets a little bit unclear about what exactly happened. But in some ways, the case is a bit kind of like Jack the Ripper, in that there's this established fact and then there's a lot of circumspection about things. But so after Trotman had finished installing the work in this area, he returned to Alsace. So I think this would have been kind of late July 1869. But about a month after he'd left, Kink announced that he was following Trotman to Alsace to view some business prospects in the area in order to facilitate the movement of the family back to Alsace permanently. This was completely against his wife's wishes, but he left in August 1869 and went to Alsace. A lot of what was happening, of what actually happened in Alsace, is unknown. It's interesting that there were very few reports or sightings of the pair in Alsace after Kink's arrival. Where they were is essentially a small hamlet. So if they were moving around a lot, you would have thought they would have been seen and noted, particularly given they were both from the area and things, but there's very few reports of them actually moving around. I think the kind of more factual part of the story is what happened back on the other side of France with Hortense. Because she couldn't read, I think as a consequence of that, she couldn't recognize her husband's handwriting either. But after some weeks, she received a letter from her husband asking her to send 5,500 francs to Alsace in cash through the mail. So I think from what I can establish, this would be about $70,000 US today. So it was a fairly substantial amount of money. Jean had said that he wanted this money to secure a business prospect that they had found. He was very unclear about what it actually was. And after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, she did send the money. But soon after this, she received another letter from Kink and Trotman that Kink and Trotman had been called to Paris on urgent business, and that Gustave, the eldest son, had to now travel to Alsace to recover the money, which was sitting in a post-restant office. So in early September, Gustave set off on this mission. But once in Alsace, he had to wait for an authority, a notarized authority, to be sent by his mother to give him authority to recover the money from the post restant. But unfortunately, instead of sending this authority to a relative of her husband's address, she sent it to the same post restant address. So Gustave never actually received the authority for the money. So it was never recovered. On his own initiative, he travelled to Paris to see his father to get further instructions. So Hortense then received a telegram telling in mid-September 1869, telling her to travel to Paris to meet with Jean and Gustave, and that everything would be explained. And she was to bring 500 francs, so about $6,000 US, all the children and all the title deeds to all the houses and property that Kink owned. So on the 19th of September 1869, it was a Sunday, she travelled to Paris. This was a huge undertaking for an illiterate woman who was 6 months pregnant, shepherding five children from the ages of 13 to nearly three, was the youngest girl. When she arrived in Paris, Jean and Gustave were not there to meet her, as had been arranged. Only Trotman was there. It was quite late at night. It was about 10 o'clock at night when she arrived. Trotman said that he would take them to meet Jean. So they caught a cab to the outskirts of Paris, to the area where Trotman had worked earlier that year and was very familiar with. He ordered the coach to stop near a field and asked Hortense to accompany him across the field to meet Jean. But the two younger children, Alpha and Marie, began to cry, and Trotman eventually agreed to let them come too. The elder boys, Emile, Henri and Achille, stayed with the cab driver. About 20 minutes later, Trotman returned to the cab. So it was only a pretty short time. It wasn't like he was gone for an hour or something. The cab driver reported that Trotman was on his own, he was dressed the same, he wasn't dishevelled in any way. He paid the cab driver and walked off into the field with the other three boys. In the morning after, so this would have been the 20th of September, a farmer who worked this plot of land, so it was kind of like would have been a small market garden. So overnight he saw that a piece of earth had been dug, and that there was a trail of blood, a blood-stained handkerchief on the ground. He went to it, and after a little scruffing around in the soil, he saw a small child's hand. So he sounded the alarm.
And this is where your novel opens, the bodies being discovered and then recovered from their burial site. What did the crime scene look like when the police finally arrived? What did they discover exactly?
Well, by the time... The investigation was led by Monsieur Claude, who was the Paris chief of police. So quite a high-ranking official was put on the case pretty quickly. But by the time he got to the field, chaos had pretty much erupted because hundreds and hundreds of people had descended on the field to look at the bodies being uncovered. Like, the, you know, there were reports of somehow the news got back into central Paris. People just fled or ran to the scene. I think, yeah, an interesting side here is there was this kind of incredibly gory kind of element to Paris, or voyeuristic element to Paris. The actual morgue in one of the morgues, the main morgue in Paris, which was on the island in the river behind, it was built behind Notre Dame, it's not there anymore, was actually open to the public. So people were actually allowed to go and view bodies that were on display behind glass cabinets, unidentified bodies, so that they could be identified. Like, there were bodies who'd been pulled from the Seine, drowned, murdered bodies. And it was quite regular for women, men to go and just view these bodies. It was actually in an American tourist guide of the time that you could go and view bodies in the morgue. So there was this kind of incredibly kind of odd element, which I think spilled over into people running to this field to see these bodies that were still lying in the shallow grave. But during Claude's examination of the site, he realised that Hortense was actually still warm. They tried to revive her, but she actually died at the site. But it does mean, particularly from the position of some of the children's bodies, that it looked like they had been buried alive, as well as they'd fought to get out. The injuries of all of them were fairly extensive. There was over 100 stab wounds. There were also puncture wounds and kind of evidence of strangulation as well. So once this had been uncovered, you know, Paris just literally erupted. With horror. How could this have happened? Napoleon III had promised them all that they were safe, and yet this horrendous crime had happened pretty much on the outskirts of Paris.
What was the evidence found at the scene, and what was Monsieur Claude able to deduce during his initial examination of the crime scene?
Well, a lot had been lost because, you know, so many people had traipsed over everything, but quite quickly, they were aware that Hortense was pregnant and had actually gone into labour while she'd been buried, which just increases the horror of the whole thing. Within a few days, though, they had pretty much identified the bodies and then realised that Jean and Gustave were missing. So they became the chief suspects. The press really had a field day with this because it finally gave them a story to illustrate the decay of the Second Empire, but also that Napoleon III had exercised, in the early part of the empire, had exercised pretty tight control of the press. So this gave them something to really kind of fight back against him with. The case is often cited as the birth of tabloid journalism, because a lot of the reports in the newspapers were constructed to instill fear in the readers. You know, this could happen to your family in this out-of-control state that they're kind of living in.
Monsieur Claude was a pretty capable investigator, wasn't he?
He was, I think at this stage, he was in his mid-60s. He, as I said, he was the chief of police. He had a long history of able investigations, really. So he was the right person to lead the investigation.
So how was Trautmann linked to the murders of Hortense and her children? And how did the police arrest him?
Well, I think there was a large dollop of very good luck involved in all of this. 2 days later in Le Havre, which is a port city on the western side of France, so not that far from Paris, but out to on the coast. At that stage, it was a port city. People were leaving France through and arriving in France through this city. So a young police officer questioned a young man just for his identity papers. It was pretty much a standard request. It wasn't anything particularly out of the ordinary. But the young man panicked and jumped into one of the canals to try to drown himself. He was rescued by someone working on a boat nearby. But when he was pulled out of the canal, all the documents of Jean Kink's life were concealed in his jacket. So initially it was thought he was Gustave. He refused to speak. The young man refused to speak or say anything. But when he was brought back to Paris, he was confronted with the bodies at the morgue. He was confronted with the bodies of the mother and the children. And he signed a document as Jean-Baptiste Trotman. So he'd pretty much identified himself. The murders happened on Sunday night and were discovered on Monday morning. And he was pretty much arrested by Thursday.
What did Trotman confess in his first interrogation?
Yeah, initially he maintained that Gustave and Jean had killed the family, that they had then escaped to America and he was in Le Havre to follow at that stage. But he maintained that Jean suspected that his wife had had a long affair and that the only child that was his was Gustave, and Gustave had acted because he was horrified with his mother. So initially, his first confession was, you know, pretty much the easy one, that he blamed it on the missing family members.
Then police discover the body of the eldest boy, Gustave Kink. How was he killed?
By this stage, the field where the bodies had been discovered had become a carnival. There were literally, you know, people having picnics out on the field. There were pony rides for children to entertain children so the parents could go off and look at where the gravesite was. So the field had been completely trampled by this stage, but somehow, and it does seem fairly extraordinary, the body of Gustave was buried, in a shallow grave away from where the mother had and the mother and the other children had been buried, but not a substantial difference, quite close. So his body was recovered, and it was estimated that he had been murdered before the mother, just from the decay of the body. He had a knife kind of pretty much embedded in his throat that had gone, I think it was embedded in his spine as well. So he had died. It was pretty much established he had died before the mother and the other children.
And soon they have a funeral for the Kink family, and it's a pretty massive affair, isn't it? A lot of Paris turns out for it.
Yeah, a bidding war got underway for which city was going to bury the bodies, because, you know, this case had reached so much notoriety that the cities involved all recognised that whoever buried them would have a great tourist attraction, really. So even the cities in Alsace were bidding for it, and Hortense's parents wanted the bodies brought back to be near them up in the north of Paris, which was eventually where they were buried, yeah.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the golden age of piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mischief Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
So finally, Trautman makes a full confession, doesn't he? What does he admit to?
Well, prior to that, he did tailor his confessions to the incoming information. So once Gustav's body had been found, he maintained that something must have changed and that Jean had killed Gustav. You know, they had had an argument or something, even though Claude was telling them that the body had been killed prior to that. I think after this, more kind of information started to come in. The letters that Kink had written from Alsace to Hortense were analysed and were identified to be forgeries, that they weren't his hand. I don't think Claude was ever convinced that one person could have killed all the family members, kind of in particularly the first three, in the allotted time. Trautman would have had to have stabbed and bludgeoned and strangled three people and not ruffled his clothes, not got, you know, there was no blood staining or no visible blood staining when he went back to the cab. So all of that would have had to have happened in 20 minutes, which is impossible, really. Yeah, so, and also after the murders, there were reports that Trautman had been seen in the days after the murder in Paris with some other men who were not Jean and Gustave. Claude continually confronted Trautman with the evidence that there just had to be other people involved, but he denied any involvement of others and just continually said that it was done by Jean and Gustave. But then Claude then really started to initiate searches to try and find Kink. He did searches internationally, but they were pretty fruitless to see if he had travelled to America, as Trautman maintained, but he would have travelled under false identity documents, so it was pretty hard to establish that. But eventually, Kink's body was found in Alsace, up in the hills above a small town called Chennai. We actually were lucky. I went there and we found the spot where the body had been found. It was up in these hills in the ruins of this old castle. It's now pretty destroyed. There's not much of it kind of left. But Kink had been poisoned and with crudely made cyanide and left just, he was just sitting by a tree. So when Claude confronted Trautman with this, he confessed that he and Jean had actually met up with some other men in Alsace who wanted to counterfeit money. So it was kind of an easy road to making more money. This is why they had asked Hortense to send the 5,500 francs because they needed to buy some machinery and to set it up. But everything hadn't really gone to plan. Trotman claimed that Jean had overheard some of these other men that they were involved with, who were Prussians, talking about a state secret that Jean had decided to go to Paris and tell the authorities about. When these other Prussian men got whiff of this, they demanded that King was killed. I mean, this is the story that that Trotman confessed to. He wouldn't confess the name of his accomplices because he said that they had made threats against his family, so he wouldn't confess up these names. So as the case had caused such public outcry and unrest and was fanned, you know, pretty much daily by the newspapers, Claude was under kind of a huge pressure to get it resolved and get a guilty party and to bury the whole thing, get it out of the papers. So, you know, for 3 months, pretty much from September through to, well, nearly 4 months, you know, there was just this escalating hype around it. So he was under a lot of pressure to get it solved.
Do you think that there is any validity to Trotman's suggestion that he and John Kink were going to start a counterfeiting business together?
Well, it's hard to... There's no hard proof of this. There's no kind of evidence of this, really, except that he very adroitly put this story together in isolation, if he did it. One of the things that makes me think that is that he had inherited his father's ability to be an inventor, and I think that went across the board to include inventing stories. But he had synthesized the cyanide, which was used to kill Kink. But the interesting thing in that is that this chemical was also used in counterfeiting to help coat coins, lower value coins, with a golden kind of substance to actually make them appear to have more value. So his synthesizing this chemical had two jobs. It could have been involved in counterfeiting, but it was definitely involved in King's death. So yeah, from a historical point of view, I don't think there's much evidence to really back this up. But from a novelistic point of view, it was a great drama. It was a great thing to situate a drama around.
So what was the trial like for Trotman? What were some of the more interesting aspects of the trial?
Well, again, the hype and the public outrage continued on into the trial, which was held in late December after Christmas, about, I think it was the 28th, 29th, 30th of December, so just after Christmas. The tickets to the public gallery were completely booked out. There were people scalping them for huge amounts of money outside before the trial started. So over the 3 days of the trial, the evidence was presented to convict Trotman completely. He was represented or constructed as a liar, that he'd changed his confession 3 times, that he had sought to pretty much just gain access to King's fortune by killing the family. But the prosecution also argued in, you know, pretty strong terms that because Trotman's hands were so large and strong, that this had enabled him to be able to strangle 2 children at the one time, and hence he'd been able to do the murders in the time that had been allocated to it. Even though last-minute evidence was brought forward that Trotman had been seen with other men after the, in the morning after the murders, he still wouldn't confess their names, and he was after 3 days, after very little deliberation, really, he was sentenced to death by guillotine for the murders of 8 people.
It's so horrifying imagining the murder of that poor family. If he'd committed them by himself, to think that those children would have watched him kill their siblings one by one, it would have to have been terrifying for them.
I think that's precisely it, that he couldn't have done it alone. I just don't see how you could control, you know, three people. So he did it in two lots of three people. How you could control two other people while you're murdering one person. I mean, okay, it may only take, you know, I don't know, 5-10 seconds to incapacitate someone so they can't move anymore. But in that 10 seconds, one of the other people or two of the other people could move out of range. And while the other person's being dispatched, the other person's got another 10 seconds. So in 20 seconds, you could move quite quickly. And it was dark. You know, it was dark. It wasn't like this was happening in daylight where he could see where other people were. So, I mean, this is one of the major things that I think really does point towards the fact that he had to have had accomplices to do it.
Talk about the days leading up to the execution, if you don't mind. What were his final days like?
He's maintained through it all that he had accomplices, but he wouldn't name them. So I think to a large degree he had pretty much accepted his fate, that he just, there was no escape for him. There were appeals for clemency to Napoleon III, but they were knocked back. His execution happened on the 19th of January 1870. It was completely a public execution in a square outside the prison. Someone in the square fell from a tree. They'd been trying to get a bit of view of what was going on and died. Trotman maintained to the end that he had accomplices, but that he wouldn't name them. So he had died, but not without one or two more noteworthy things happening. During the execution, in the hours leading up to the execution, a troop of writers, including the Russian Turgenev, were allowed to follow the last hour of Trotman's life. From the time that he was woken at 6 a.m. to the execution at 7, Turgenev wrote the most bizarre account of these hours leading up to the death. It really was finding, when I found that piece of writing, it was one of the things that really did kind of spur me on with the project. Also, a famous chiromancer, Deborah, was allowed to make a cast of Trotman's hand. At that stage, the science of phrenology and chiromancy were keen to link facial and hand features to a crime. This was one of my original interests in the case. At the time in 2000, the Clinton administration had overseen the mapping of the human genome, and all kinds of claims were suddenly being made about the tight link between genetic influence and all manner of human behaviour. The link between the genetic expression in the shape of a hand and psychopathy in 1870s France suddenly didn't seem so outrageous to me. Basically, a hand is an expression of a genetic identity, and Deborah was trying to link this to characteristics of a personality. I'd also seen a collection of face death masks at the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. And I'd seen Trotman's hand, the cast of Trotman's hand at the police museum in Paris. The hands, it is unusual. The thumb's incredibly long. I think it's made more unusual by the fact it's kind of thrust off this bust, which just makes it look malevolent, like this thing is clawing out of the base that it's attached to.
Wasn't there some story about Trotman biting off someone's finger or thumb just before he was killed?
Yeah, in the final seconds of his life, he somehow managed to... He'd been put strapped to the plank of the guillotine and lowered into position. The collar had been put around his neck to keep him in place, and he somehow managed to skew his head sideways and bit the hand of one of the assistants who was involved in the execution, causing that to bleed, and it just added to the hysteria and the hype that was kind of happening around the execution.
So the scene you said at the beginning of the interview about the state of affairs in France under Napoleon, you said he was losing popularity and potentially on the verge of losing power. And this is on the eve of the Franco-German War. Did these murders have any influence on the war itself, which would come less than a year after the murders were committed, right?
Yeah, it was literally pretty much a year after the bodies of the mother and the children were found on the field. The Prussians had invaded Paris. It was almost to the day, I think. Well, this is, this is the area for ripe kind of speculation. That in Claude's notes on the case, in his memoir, he speculates that there was this report that Kink had overheard something from these Prussians and was going to go to Paris and tell authorities of this. The speculation around that was enough for Claude to kind of think that possibly there had been some involvement of Prussians in Alsace who were wanting to bring about some kind of event within Paris or within France that would force Napoleon III to attack Prussia, so that Prussia would not be seen as the aggressor, that it would be France that was the aggressor. What this event was exactly is not really written down or known, but again was an area of kind of fairly ripe speculation for me as a novelist to kind of imagine what this event that Kink had heard about was. You know, there is another area of thought. This again, you know, keys back into my comparison to it being similar to Jack the Ripper, in that there was another area of consideration that the left of France had actually brought this about to basically destabilize the government. So that they had somehow engineered this murder to happen to just destabilize the government. Again, there's no evidence of these things. They're just kind of speculation, really.
How can people learn more about your work and buy your book?
Well, you can go to my website, which I try to update, but being a busy author, it's often not, it's hard to do that, which is www.gsjohnston.com, or just go to Amazon, which has got links to my author page and to the novels there as well. So I think The Cast of a Hand is only available through Amazon at the moment. So there's the printed edition or the Kindle edition.
Thank you again for your time.
Well, thank you very much for your time. It was lovely to talk about it all again.
This has been the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day, there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. So listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.